My name is Archie Jarman. I work for the Horticulture Innovation Lab. My presentation is a little bit different than Luis's. That was a great, lot of information. My hope is that maybe at the end of this, you come away and you realize that you have this, like a toolkit in terms of horticulturists that is incredibly valuable for international development. There's a need, if you don't already travel in terms of your work, there's an absolute need out there and you can. So I guess I'll go through my trajectory of figuring that out. So this is the title. So this is, I want to go over where I was in college. I came into, I was at UC Santa Cruz, and you can see on this scale that my idealism was way high. So that's the smiley face up there, but I had very little direction in terms of what I wanted to do. I just knew I really wanted to get out there, travel internationally, try to help people globally, but I had no idea where to start. And then I also wanted to include, I think there's a healthy level of idealism, and I was not healthy at that point, by far. So my first trip was to Ecuador. I did this through UC Santa Cruz. Spent about 7 months there working with low-income families that sell fruits and vegetables in a market in Quito. The goal of the program was to really encourage kids to go to school. So families would be moving to Quito, to the city, thinking that they'd get a higher income from rural areas. The transition is incredibly difficult. They end up really struggling, and in Ecuador they actually charge a school fee. So a lot of the families couldn't even enroll their kids in school, and a lot of the children would actually hang out at the fruit and vegetable markets for the whole day. The intervention was to either pay for the schooling or to work with the kids through tutoring sessions in the market. But while I was there, there's this huge interaction. You know, I'm surrounded by fruits and vegetables, but even at that point, I didn't really recognize that as this kind of common nexus of international development. So I'm motivated, still idealistic, not really sure what to do, but I started an organization with a friend down there called UBESI. It actually still runs. It's been almost 15 years. The goal of UBESI was to actually focus on two markets in Quito that were not being addressed by current interventions. It's probably the best way to explain it is actually through a video, but then I'll play that video now. I hope. Maybe not. Oh well. So this is a video that didn't play. I thought it embedded correctly. But so UBESI, the goal of UBESI is partially a volunteer organization where we draw volunteers globally. They come in and they work with fruit and vegetable vendors and their families. And really, one of the primary goals is to give kids that are in the market most of the day working with their parents. They're actually, some of them are very young, but they need to earn an income. Give them time to do something else that is maybe expands, not necessarily their horizon, but their skill set. So that could be schoolwork, or it could be playing, or it could be interactive games with each other. And then that will lead into usually scholarships for the local school system. So here I am. I'm starting to move towards a little bit more direction. My idealism's going down a bit, but I'm still not sure what to do. So I end up going to Burma. And I was in Burma for about 3.5 months. And this was after the tsunami that happened in Thailand. So I originally went to Burma hoping to do some hurricane relief work or tsunami relief work, but the Burmese government had actually shut down the coastal areas to outsiders because they didn't want any information leaking out of Burma to let them know about the actual impact. Essentially, the propaganda was that there was no impact. So I ended up primarily in Chang Tung, which is a village north near the Thai border, and I worked in malaria suppression and building hydroelectric dams to provide lighting, and then also some minor education component. One thing in terms of fruits and vegetables that I want to mention is that every meeting had some fruit, peanuts, or tea that was served. So again, there's this nexus that was happening. I was still not aware of it, but there's this common component of the work that I was doing. And this is, you can see me and young me hopping into the truck heading to the village sites. This is a picture of, we would distribute dried fish. It was kind of a nice welcoming to every village we came to, and this is us gathering and distributing the dried fish. So the idealism is going lower, direction's getting better, but I'm still pretty lost on what to do. So then I entered the fire service for about 4 years. I went to paramedic school. I worked in Asheville, North Carolina, still, you know, having a good time and satisfying the need in terms of helping people, but I had this drive to want to get back into international work. I'm incredibly thankful for the time that I was there. I learned a lot of skill sets that I actually still apply now, but I just missed the travel. So now I know I want to do international development work for sure. So I enrolled in Columbia University. I got into a master's program there. And part of one of my internships was with the Millennium Villages Project. This is Jeffrey Sachs' organization. And as part of my workload, I actually evaluated conditional cash transfer programs in Brazil, Ethiopia, and Mexico to see what their impact is on MUAC scores for children, so middle upper arm circumference scores. You probably read a lot of the studies that have come out. They're incredibly effective. Some of these programs are massive. Bolsa Familia in Brazil is just massive, and so is Opportunities in Mexico. But I'm starting to get this idea about the importance of nutrition for children. So getting more direction, less idealism. After graduate school, I got hired with Arcadia Biosciences. They're based in Davis, California, and they had three projects working in international development with USAID, working with transgenic rice, wheat, and... just rice and wheat. I apologize. One of the programs was the NUE rice program in Indonesia, NUE being nitrogen use efficiency. The project was promoted in Indonesia because the Indonesian government has a high interest in reducing greenhouse gas emissions in any way they possibly can because their islands are so close to sea level already. So one of the interventions in terms of NUE is that you reduce greenhouse gas emissions because you're having lower nitrogen fertilizer rates. So we had a comment, we were actually in collaboration with UC Davis. We were testing the greenhouse gas emissions from this transgenic rice to see if the levels were lower, and also to test the yields and test sites in Indonesia. Also, we had a project working with salt-tolerant rice in Bangladesh. The salt-tolerant rice was in an indica variety, and it was five different constructs that were put together in Davis, California. And we tested it with the Bangladesh Rice Research Institute. They have done greenhouse trials of the salt-tolerant varieties, but the big lesson learned from that was how to move transgenic material to Bangladesh through the regulatory system. We also had an NUE rice project in Nigeria and Ghana working with AATF. This was in their Nerika variety, new rice for Africa. They did trials in Ghana, Uganda, and Nigeria, and the hope is to have, is more on along the lines of higher yields. Lower fertilizer rates, but honestly what the goal was is to get higher yields from their variety. So the idealism is going lower, the direction's getting better, but what I found with these projects is definitely much more, I don't know if hygienic is the right word, but there are research trials, a lot of laboratory setting, and I felt like there was something missing in terms of getting your hands dirty. So then I got hired with the Horticulture Innovation Lab. It's great. I love working for the Horticulture Innovation Lab. It meets all the needs that in terms of international development that I've ever wanted. As a background in the Horticulture Innovation Lab, we're funded by USAID through the Feed the Future program. Innovation labs, there's 22 of them in the country, and they have a different focus area in agriculture. Ours is horticulture. So we work with smallholder fruit and vegetable growers with the focus also on gender equity and youth empowerment. My mandate with the Horticulture Innovation Lab in terms of international work is I manage two regional centers that are hubs of innovation that are located in Honduras and Thailand that work in South America, Central America, and Southeast Asia. These are essentially training hubs and research hubs. But what I loved about working for the Horticulture Innovation Lab is that there's much more direct contact with the smallholder farmers in terms of the projects we do. I think I have a great slide to present, so this is a great picture in terms of work in Guatemala, also in Guatemala. But this is, I kind of guess I can stay on this for a while because I think I still have tons of time. I found horticulture after all the international development work to be really a nexus. Beth mentioned yesterday that she just feels so lucky to be in horticulture. So everybody here that is an expert, and I have no background in it. My background's in international policy. I'm envious because I've taken this long, winding road, and most of the people here have this toolkit that is really, it's super dynamic in terms of international travel and international development work. Our work in terms of growing fruits and vegetables or post-harvest management of fruits and vegetables touches on all these areas in terms of water, health, income, gender equity, youth, sustainability, climate change adaptation, and resilience. So for somebody that was having a hard time finding direction with high idealism but really wanted to travel the world, horticulture offers this broad, impact in terms of being dynamic enough that I'm constantly learning about gender roles, youth challenges, all in the context of fruit and vegetable growers. So I really want to promote that for everybody here that this is a great skill set that you have and it's needed for international development. And I'll highlight especially post-harvest. So post-harvest, we had a guy, I also manage a demonstration center at UC Davis, and we had a professor that came by who's been involved in international post-harvest work for 30 years. And one reason why he loved it is because it's so approachable. So post-harvest work with fruits and vegetables, I don't have the technical background, but in terms of the basic kind of hop up to where you have an impact, you're just understanding keeping it cool or drying it out. Those are the two approaches. And with that, even with somebody with not an agricultural engineering background, I can really introduce technologies, I can speak to technologies that are impactful, and I can also even be creative enough to kind of think about ways to modify and improve those technologies. So it's a great area to go into. Uh-oh. Does anybody have any questions? I've got 15 minutes, so I can answer a lot of questions. Or just chat about things. Go ahead. So, excellent question. So, the question was, it actually seemed like I had more of a direct path in terms of international development and rather than a winding path, and then how did I find those experiences. So at UC Santa Cruz, I did my bachelor's degree was in social work, essentially, and part of that was an internship abroad or in-country or domestic. And I took advantage of that to travel somewhere. In terms of the long, winding road, I remember my application for what I wanted to do, and essentially was, I want to travel and find out what the problems are and fix them on site. No direction at all. I had no idea. I just knew that I really wanted to go. John Bowman mentioned yesterday, I think you were in there, that there kind of three categories in terms of international development, specifically for anything but for horticulture, specializing in something, just having an eagerness to travel and a willing and somebody that really wants to help. So I kind of fell into two categories. I just knew I wanted to travel and I knew I wanted to help. So I took advantage of that opportunity. And then for the travel to Burma, it's one of those funny things where we had a family friend that ran the Foundation for the People of Burma. And that's, I guess, I was working as a group and lighting technician for like a film warehouse, and it was just one of those things where I just took the opportunity when it came up. And I highly encourage that. Just even if you have a terrible experience, it's still valuable. I can, in terms of Burma, I wasn't allowed there anymore. So I went there in 2005, and here I am in riding around on a scooter, clearly not on a tour for 3 months, and I've made their list, and I wasn't allowed back. But Burma now is, there's still major, major challenges, but there's a huge development effort there. We were just talking to Winrock in Thailand, and a huge amount of funding is going into Burma, and it's a amazing country. It's like traveling back in time 70 years, and the people are amazing there. They're really special. Any other questions? Yeah. So after traveling, what do you feel like are the main characteristics in terms of developing countries? That's a really hard question. I'll speak to it in terms of horticulture. I feel like, and I'm glad Beth is following me because she can speak to this. One of the ones that I want to focus on is post-harvest issues. That is absolutely universal. So it doesn't matter if we're working in Southeast Asia, Central America, or Africa, post-harvest issues are a major challenge. So having that skill set in terms of introducing low-cost technologies is universal. There's other dynamics that are interesting that come into play. Rwanda, in terms of a government, is incredibly supportive of development work, and then other governments are less supportive. But in terms of common issues, there's some that transcend everywhere. Go ahead. Great question. So are we focused on, in terms of post-harvest, safety, food safety, or being able to store the product longer? And I'll say both. So we have in Cambodia a food safety program that is dedicated to the food safety side. That doesn't mean that project hasn't incorporated some of the storage side too. But in other areas, it's much more of a focus just on being able to store it longer. And I guess I have the time, I'll put in a dig for the dry card. So there's the other side of it is not only storing fresh product longer, we really are promoting something called the dry chain, which is not a new concept, it's just a term for the cold, essentially the dry version of the cold chain. So storing a product below 65% relative humidity, drying a product below that, storing the product in hermetic storage so it can't rehydrate, and transporting it under those same conditions. Really simple idea, but this could have a major impact if it's implemented correctly in terms of aflatoxin and food losses. So the big issue is how do you know when it's dry enough? I bet a lot of people who travel in this group, how do farmers know when their corn is dry enough? They bite it, they shake it in their hands, they listen to it. I don't know, I wouldn't be surprised if in some cases that's really effective, but overall it's not true. You can't trust it, especially when it's going from a farmer to an aggregator and an aggregator to somewhere else. So the Horticulture Innovation Lab came up with something called the dry carb, which is a cobalt chloride strip that reads the relative humidity in the air. And if it's below 65% relative humidity, you have the conditions that are right for storage and it's been dried properly. So are most of the countries exporting, or are they keeping it for home consumption? So that varies, but I'd say that our mandate is smallholder farmers, so that really kind of changes our focus in terms of where the market is, and Bethan can speak to this too, is that smallholder farmers by definition is something under 2 hectares. So you're really working with a group that doesn't have, in terms of exporting it outside the country, does not have the capacity because they don't have the product. So our main focus is either home consumption or to a local market or to a major city within the country. I'd say it's probably the most of where our interventions are. That isn't to say that we recognize the importance of markets internationally, and we do try to promote the same practices that would lead to those markets internationally. But the capacity of the country or the people that we work with just might not be there.
Yeah, so okay,
any other questions? No questions? Okay, and we don't have any coffee. Okay. That was my backup. I guess we'll have a little break in between the Lauren coming down, but I really appreciate your time. Feel free to come back.